From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, this year's vicious flu season has scientists seeking a better way to make the flu vaccine.
The time it takes right now to produce a vaccine, from the time the virus is identified to the time we have significant amounts of vaccine, is probably about 6 months.
Should the governor be picking university trustees in Michigan?
A governor, a sitting governor in any state, is far more accountable to the population, I think, than a member of a board of a university who's got an 8-year term.
Sutton's Bay singer-songwriter Chris Andrews on his walk across the USA.
There is no better way to see the real America than going 3 miles an hour.
And undergraduate engineering students solve problems for a Tier 1 supplier. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The winter of our discontent drags on and on. That discontent has a name, the flu. This nation is in the middle of an especially bad and deadly influenza season. And even as we're all told we should get a flu shot, we are hearing that this year's flu vaccine isn't very effective. Let's talk about why this is and whether it's time to rethink our approach to preventing the flu. Dr. Arnold Manto is with us. He's a professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan and an internationally recognized influenza expert. It is good to have you with us, Dr. Manto.
Glad to be here.
Get us past the headlines. You know, there's so many screaming headlines in newscasts and newspapers about flu. Where, in your view, does this current flu season stand in terms of hitting us hard, taking lives, and not going away?
Well, it is a bad season. We would not have predicted it would have been so bad because we have the same type of influenza predominating, what we call AH3N2, as we had last year. And maybe we're not getting hit quite as bad in Michigan as in other parts of the country because we had a fair amount of that kind of flu around last year. But it's hard to say. What's clear is that it's been bad all over, and it's a question of bad or worse.
Am I right? Is that true that it seems that we're having more deaths?
Well, the kind of flu we're having, which is AH3N2, is known to be the worst actor. We have type A, we have type B, and we have two kinds of type A, and this is the worst actor of them all. What's happening is we have a double whammy. We have a lot of transmission of a bad flu virus, and what's probably going on as well is that the vaccine isn't working as well as we would like.
I'm hearing 10% effective. What's your take on how effective it is?
Well, it's the numbers are going to come out from CDC. We're one of the participating institutions in trying to figure this out. We have a study along with Henry Ford Hospital System, and we track how frequently people who get the flu and who don't get the flu are vaccinated. So we're part of that system. What I can say is that it's not going to be as good as we wanted it to be. Canada came out with numbers around 10%, and it's probably going to be fairly close.
All right. Before we talk about what we can do better, let's talk about what we should know right now as we're in the middle of a flu season that isn't letting up. If you haven't had a shot, is it still worth it to get one?
It is probably still reasonable to get a shot. I'm quibbling a little bit because I think we may be at the top or beginning to pass the top of the flu season. It takes a couple of weeks to get immunity, but we've had flu seasons extending into April, and I suspect what's going to happen is that by the end of February, a lot of the excitement will be passed, but we'll have some rumbling flu for the next couple of months. It might switch over to another type, all of which are contained in the vaccine.
If you didn't get a vaccine, you got the flu, are you good or should you still get a vaccine for,
well,
can you catch it again?
This, well, you can catch it again, but I think the timing is getting a little late. Probably if you haven't been vaccinated by the end of February, it won't be worth it. But we have to remember we do have an antiviral that works against influenza. It's underused, but it has been useful, especially if you give it early enough.
Is that Tamiflu?
That is Tamiflu.
Yes, and that is something children and adults can take with supervision, right?
Actually, the studies, because of what happened in the 2009 flu pandemic, they tested it down to infants. So it can be given even in young children. And it is relatively safe and effective if given early enough. I use the word relatively because any medication is going to have some side effects. The clear side effects of Tamiflu are a little bit of vomiting, and 8% people have nausea. Usually, if you take it with food, you don't have that problem.
So Tamiflu and flu shot, we're early in February, so it would not be unreasonable to think you should get one.
Exactly.
All right. So now you have been researching influenza since the mid-1960s. How do you think that we have done in preventing or curbing the flu in this country?
Well, we have not attached enough importance to flu. Every year we rediscover flu, especially in a year like this. But it's predictable. We know it's going to come back in every winter, sometimes very hard, sometimes not so hard. And then we have the pandemics.
And when we say pandemics,
that's when we have a totally new strain and it circulates all over the world in a relatively short period of time. Now, it is of interest to people in the state of Michigan that the vaccine was originally developed here by Thomas Francis, who founded our Department of Epidemiology, along with Jonas Salk. And it was developed and first tested during the Second World War in 1943 among University of Michigan students. Hmm. The principle of the way the vaccine is produced is the same as the vaccine we are using now. And that's why the National Institutes of Health, recognizing that we have a good but not a great vaccine, is establishing a research agenda to try to move things forward to get us off use of an old vaccine and start using new technology.
So what do you think? If you imagine what a better vaccine would be, and I'm sure it's a delicate balance, making a vaccine that lasts longer, but at the same time, less sensitive.
And is totally safe.
Safe and less sensitive to that virus changing from season to season.
Right. That's why people talk about a universal vaccine, which means it doesn't have to be changed every year to meet what's circulating. And that's the problem is we have to predict. There's going to be a meeting at WHO and then another meeting at FDA on the 1st of March, and they're going to pick the vaccine strains for next year on the basis of whatever information we have now. The virus can change between now and when it needs to be used.
And therefore, we get the headline saying it's not as effective as we want it to
be. Right, and that's part of the problem. Yeah. The other part is that we produce the vaccine in eggs. And the eggs with this bad H3N2 virus, the virus mutates in order to be able to grow well in eggs. And therefore, what we are getting is different from what is circulating. And that's the other problem. And these are soluble problems. But we want to have a vaccine that has two characteristics that we don't have now. Broader protection, so we can protect against more than exactly what is in the vaccine, and also longer duration. So we don't have to get vaccine every year because we have another issue, and that is we at the University of Michigan found for the first time that if you get vaccine 2 years in a row, it may not be as effective as getting it in the current year. So then there's immunologic reasons behind this. So the best way to solve this problem is to have a vaccine that you don't have to get every year. And that's on the list of goals, the wish list of a better vaccine.
And what's needed to achieve that wish list?
Well, what we need is funding. And this is what the National Institutes of Health are working on, along with other federal agencies like the CDC. We're funded by the CDC and the National Institutes of Health, and we are examining many of these characteristics, what produces protection, because we need a better understanding of what protects us. So we're looking at what we call correlates of protection, why some people who get the flu vaccine are protected and why some people are not.
This is the 100th anniversary of the great flu pandemic of 1918, and that one killed 20 to 40 million people around the world, 675,000 here in the U.S. When you're lying awake at night and thinking, do you ever find yourself thinking and wondering if we would find ourselves in something resembling that pandemic?
Well, we could. And there are going to be several meetings during the course of the year looking at exactly that. I don't think that we would have the same problems. First of all, they didn't know it was a virus. And they were using vaccines for bacteria and the rest because there was confusion about what was causing it. The influenza virus was first identified from people in about 1934. This was the end of the First World War. So any able men were off because of draft and everything else. People didn't know that they shouldn't be in close contact with one another. And there was a parade, Liberty Bond Parade in Philadelphia during the start of the pandemic, and they had one of the highest attack rates for 2 weeks afterwards during the 1918 pandemic, and it was mainly in the fall, the autumn.
So it could, but there are things we know now that they didn't know.
And we have antivirals.
Yes.
The problem is that the time it takes right now to produce a vaccine, from the time the virus is identified to the time we have significant amounts of vaccine, is probably about 6 months. And that's why agencies of the federal government have been looking at ways to streamline this. And that's one of the goals of the universal vaccine. The thing about a universal vaccine, though, is the goals of using that vaccine in a pandemic would be different from the goals in seasonal flu. In a pandemic, you're going to accept a vaccine which doesn't stop flu completely, mm-hmm. but keeps you alive. With seasonal flu, we don't want to be sick. And we expect to be able to say that we are protected completely against clinical flu.
That pandemic vaccine sounds like the hose that the firefighters use when the house is burning.
That's right. And the question is, can we use a same kind of universal vaccine for both? I think that that's a long-term goal. The short-term goal should be improving what we've got right now.
Dr. Arnold Manto, Francis Collegiate Professor of Public Health, epidemiologist and flu researcher with the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Up next, we'll meet the Sutton's Bay man who walked 3,200 miles across the United States to call attention to our addiction to smartphones. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Oh, I fell in love more than I could wish. Oh, oh, my angel fish. Oh, oh, my angel fish. Oh, oh, my angel fish.
That song is Angel Fish by C. Burroughs. That's the stage name for Chris Andrews, a native of Sutton's Bay. There is a special rhythm to that song. Perhaps the pace of walking? Well, that very well could be. Because Chris Andrews wrote that song and others on his new album, Angel Fish, while he walked across America. Chris Andrews is here with us now. Welcome, Chris. You walked 3,200 miles across the USA?
Yes, that's right.
Why did you do that?
Well, the whole idea to walk across the United States actually began 2 years before I ever took my first step. And really, the motivation for the whole journey was to spread a message, a simple message about finding balance in how we use our digital devices. It was simple. You know, I was a college student. I was in my third year, and I was, you know, basically in such a close relationship with my phone. It was the first thing I did when I woke up and the last thing I did when I went to bed. And I knew there was something that was unhealthy about that. And I saw that my friends were doing that too. My family was also as plugged in as I was. And, you know, as one 20-year-old, I felt like it was such a large issue. I didn't know how I would ever start addressing it. But I thought, if I can grab people's attention, then maybe I can start to move the needle in the way we perceive the value of simple face-to-face conversation, life beyond the screen. And so I thought, you know what, maybe if I walked across the country, people would say, wait a second, you know, what is this guy doing and why is he doing it? And so that was my original motivation for the trek across the country.
So it would give you, in the words of Teddy Roosevelt, a bully pulpit in which to kind of spread this message.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So the idea of writing a bunch of new songs for an album was not a part of the plan?
No. In fact, you know, I've been a musician my whole life. Grew up a jazz drummer and started playing guitar when I was at university in Scotland. But this journey was mainly for this message. And I never really imagined that I would finish with a full album on my hands. But, you know, I was given a guitar the day before I began my trip, and it actually fit perfectly in this three-wheeled cart that I pushed all the way across the country with about an inch to spare. And so I said, oh, you know what? Maybe I'll bring this thing. And as the trip progressed, I just started to use my music as a way to process what was happening, to understand the stories and, you know, also something to do in my tent at night. I was sleeping in people's lawns most of the time. I was walking across the country and I was trying to practice what I preach and find something other than scrolling through my phone, you know, to do at night. So I picked up my guitar and I wrote songs and that began to tell the story of my journey.
Give us a sense of the logistics of this. I mean, what was your path? How long did it take you to walk it? And how did you set that all up?
Yeah, so, you know, I started with a large gear list of probably more than I needed to carry, but I started from Washington, D.C. in August, and I walked south, sort of towards Nashville, and then down through Mississippi and Arkansas, then down through Texas, and by the time the winter came, I was in the south and could avoid some of the cold, and then finished in Los Angeles, California, in the spring in about March. And I was walking between 20 and 30 miles a day. People are always curious. I went through 7 pairs of shoes on that trip. I made a little tick mark with every conversation that I had along the way, and I had 10,300, and I don't know the exact number in my head right now, but over 10,000 conversations and interviews along the way, and probably over 150 lawns that I slept in as well.
Did you have an advance team helping you set up where you were going to sleep, or would you just look at an inviting house and maybe knock on the door and hope for the best?
Well, you know, the truth is my girlfriend at the time, my fiance now, was a critical piece in this whole project. She coordinated my relationship with sponsors who helped get me equipment, with schools helping me speak to students about this message, with news stations, newspapers, radio stations. And so she, and also, you know, helping me figure out where I was going to be at the end of the night, working with communities. And so I think, you know, behind the scenes, she was a big part of the whole project and continues to be moving forward.
Chris, I am really interested in the lessons you learned during your walk. First, just about the people you met.
Yeah, I'd never been to the South. I was crossing the United States at quite an interesting time.
What year did you do this?
I did this in 2016.
Ah.
And so, you know, I was entering a part of the country that was completely unknown to me. And I was forced to rely on people every single night. I knocked on about 5 to 10 doors, I would say, every night on average. And I'd say, you know, this is what I'm doing. Do you have any suggestions on a place where I might be able to stay? Or can I pitch my tent in your lawn? And people welcomed me in. They gave me what they had. They gave me life. They gave me refuge. But, you know, the way that I like to describe it in terms of my relationship with the people along the way is, you know, the East was very intense. It was a game of survival for me, and I was relying on people every night for basic necessities. And they gave me that. They gave me that life, but it was, you know, nonetheless a really intense experience. And then as I made my way westward, the country started to open up. The hills of Virginia became the delta of Mississippi, which became the desert of the West. And with that came a certain sense of freedom, a sense of, you know, this federally owned land is actually mine, and I can, as it is yours and as it is all of ours. And so I could pitch my tent and relax a little bit. And it gave me some space to process the East and the intense experience that that was. And so it really gave me an opportunity to understand that generosity, to try to come to terms with everything that I had seen, both the disturbing and the enlightening and the complex experience that it was.
You say intense, and you talk about things you saw that were disturbing, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't like to dwell on these too much because they were so few and far between. But whether it was being in a survivalist underground bunker or finding my way into a house that, you know, was not a safe place for me because of the weapons and the drugs that I saw, for example, you know, but those were such rare occasions. And when I did find myself in a situation where I felt like it was better for me to move on, I was always met with kindness, and I was always sensitive about the situation. So I never felt like I was in a, you know, a confrontation with someone, but more just me observing and saying, this might not be the best place for me to spend the night.
What most surprised you about this 3,200-mile walk across the U.S.?
You know, I think what surprised me most was that I found an answer to my question, because at the beginning, I didn't really voice this, but deep down, I wanted to find out what was at stake for me and for our society in our relationship with our phones. And I had this question, you know, I probably didn't even voice it to myself, but I went out, you know, I saw the research. I saw that our community is being affected by our relationship with our phones. Our youth is more depressed or anxious than ever. Our adults are just as sucked in as the children. And so, you know, I began this trip with a concern for myself and others, but I didn't really know what to do. And as I made my way west, what surprised me about this journey is that the act of walking for 210 days for 3,000 miles gave me answers to the question of what is at stake. And in simple terms, that is connection to ourselves and connection to the people around us.
And you had a chance to do that. And now you've turned all of this into this project you call Let's Talk. Tell us how you're going to be getting this message out.
Yeah, so I'm also writing a book about this that will be coming out in the coming year. And my music is another part of it. The documentary about my project will be released in the coming months as well. Hopefully that will be floating around the country and, you know, give some people some context on my trip and some value that they can use in their lives. Because that's, you know, that's really what I hope for Let's Talk project now, is to give people something. You know, I have gained so much from this journey, but now it is time for me to take what I've learned and give it back to people.
I know you're going to be speaking at schools around the country as part of the Let's Talk project. What would you say is your call to action when you speak?
You know, my call to action is that this is a problem. And, you know, not to say that technology is bad. In fact, I celebrate the power of technology to bring us together in some cases. It is an incredible tool for us to communicate. It is an incredible tool for us to learn. But my call to action is looking at the research, looking at the truth. As a society, we sort of walked into this relationship with our phones as being incredible, that there were no downfalls. It was just more, and more is better. But as I start to hear the research coming out about our kids who are depressed or our parents who are less patient, empathy is in real risk right now. And I believe that. And so that call to action, I think, comes at the same time as the truth, as it trickles out of research institutions that we respect as a society. And so I think that's going to continue to happen. We're going to continue to see the response or sort of the reaction to our addiction to technology and especially to our phones in the coming years. So, you know, I don't think this is something that is going to be solved overnight. But my call to action is to be a story that inspires people to change their own behavior. My call to action is that the research is coming out and I see very little change happening. I see the same, you know, amount of kids or adults who are walking down the street or sitting across the table from each other and are looking down at their phones. You know, the research isn't inspiring us enough as a society. And so I hope the Let's Talk project stands in front of people as a story, as something that people can grab onto and see the truth in. And then, you know, be a catalyst for their own change, for their own behavioral change, for the better, for personal growth, for, you know, whatever they want.
You can learn more and listen to the album Angel Fish by going to cburrowsmusic.com. And the Let's Talk Project website, you can go to letstalkusa.com. Chris Andrews, it's a remarkable journey, and thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Oh, in the deluge, yeah, the dream is washing over me. Oh, I fell in love more than I could wish.
It was one of the most significant population shifts of the entire 20th century, the Great Migration. When African Americans migrated out of the South, especially during the 1930s and 40s. Now a University of Michigan study shows the Great Migration helped the next generation, the children of those men and women who left the South. One of the study's co-authors is with us now. Catherine Massey is a scientist with the U of M Institute for Social Research. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So your study is a first in the way you use the census data. How so?
So each census has to be kept private for at least 72 years. So then in 2012, the 1940 census was fully released, which allowed researchers with Ancestry.com and the Minnesota Population Center to send the data overseas to have it digitized. And it's allowed us to link that data up to contemporary data. So we took the 1940 census and we linked it to the 2000 census.
I think most of us did not realize that that information is not just there for the taking, that 70 years have to pass.
That's right. It's kind of an interesting restriction, and you can tell they made it when lifespans were quite a bit different than they are today because, you know, 72, I think they were hoping that everybody would die before the full census was released.
But now you said you were able to link it up with data from 2000. Is that limited data?
That's right. The data from 2000 is restricted by the Census Bureau. So we did all of this research within the restricted data enclave that the Census Bureau maintains. It's called the Federal Statistical Data Research Center.
Okay.
So all of this data was kept private and confidential. We only had the results released, and they went under full review before they were released by the Census Bureau.
So what were you looking for? What was the question you wanted to answer?
Well, I think that there's this big debate in the literature even about the first generation of Black migrants who chose to move out of the South. We know that they had mixed outcomes when they moved north. A lot of people find that they had increased wages, that they had better employment opportunities. But then on the other hand, they faced higher incarceration rates. Their health suffered, so that the mortality rates are much higher for the Black migrants who moved to the north. Our question was, how does the increased income of the parents and the environment that the children are being raised in the north affect their outcomes?
And what'd you find?
Well, we found that they did benefit in terms of income, and they had lower poverty rates and higher education attainment levels.
And you were able to make that connection comparing data from 1940 and what you know of 2000.
That's right. The 1940 census is a really special census because it's one of the first ones that ever asked education and income levels. So we were able to look at the income of the parents from the 1940 census and then observe both the parents' characteristics and the children's characteristics, which really helped us figure out how well they had fared once they moved.
As I kind of look at some data from your study, so the children of those parents, of those African-American men and women who left the South, actually graduated from high school at a rate 11% higher than their Southern counterparts.
That's right.
And then also they earned more, about $1,000 more per year, 11% less likely to be in poverty. So what does that say to you?
I think this really fits into a broader literature about stagnation in the South and areas of the U.S. that are persistently high inequality, low mobility states. And these people, this was like a release valve for them. They were able to move to the North, move to better opportunities, and their children really benefited from it, as we see in this study.
Versus if they had stayed in the South.
That's right.
Now, when you think of census data, there are things you cannot address, am I correct, through census data, such as?
Oh, there are some things that we cannot observe in the data. So we don't observe attitudes. We don't observe discrimination necessarily. We can observe segregation from where people are living, which we're exploring in a new study. But in terms of their outcomes, we really only see kind of the objective measures like education attainment and income.
So it really does tell us that kind of a where you live or where you're born really does matter.
That's right.
Looking ahead to the upcoming 2020 census, what might that add to this picture?
As more and more censuses become available and we're able to track more and more families over time, a clearer picture is going to emerge of what these effects are across multiple generations and how segregation has changed over the last 100 years and the long-term effects of that on children.
So thinking of this study that you've done, you've put it out here now, it's been published. What do you hope might be done with the work you've done?
Well, I think that this research output really fits within a broader literature where we're finding that there are persistent effects across families and that it varies by geography. So it's just building more and more evidence that perhaps we need some very targeted policies to try to reduce inequality in these highly immobile, high inequality areas.
Catherine Massey, University of Michigan Institute for Social Research. She's the co-author of a study exploring the economic legacy of the Great Migration. Interesting work, Catherine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, Daniel House of the Detroit News says Michigan needs to reform how trustees are chosen for its Big Three universities. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time for our Thursday check-in with Detroit News Business columnist Daniel House. The aftermath of the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal is very much on your mind, Daniel, and you believe one result should be to reform the way trustees are chosen to govern Michigan State, the University of Michigan, and Wayne State University, the so-called Big Three. Why?
Well, we are the only state in the country that elects the trustees to our three major universities on a statewide partisan ballot. And as you get into this story, as I have over the last couple of weeks, it's interesting that the objections are all, guess what, partisan. So, I mean, we have a situation where partisan politics plays itself out in the makeup of the boards, who's the chairman, who's the vice chairman, what party they're from, how they're elected, and the parties particularly are invested in this because it gives them some measure of control in some of the state's largest institutions. And the people that are running for those positions oftentimes have no relevant experience to running a multi-billion dollar public institution. Yet there they are in making decisions and overseeing a vast bureaucracy that is fueled in part by public money.
Republican Representative James Lauer, as we know, is sponsoring a bill that would abolish the three existing boards as of December 31st mm-hmm. and let the next governor appoint new boards of trustees or governors, as the case may be, January mm-hmm. 1st. So how is letting a governor appoint the board not going to get political? I mean, wouldn't that seat be just a great way to say thanks to a big donor or someone who did the governor a favor?
Sure, of course it could be.
And be super political, partisan, I should say, to boot.
It could be. But I think let's ask a different question. And we can address that in a second. But I think the overriding thing that it does give you is it gives accountability. A governor, a sitting governor in any state, is far more accountable to the population, I think, than a member of a board of a university who's got an 8-year term. If the governor can't fire that person for or persons for doing a terrible job overseeing a university, what accountability is there? There really isn't any. And don't tell me that the accountability is that they'll be elected. Do you really think that someone is going to remember 6 years from now what so-and-so did in the Larry Nassar scandal or didn't do? I think the answer is probably not, if their name's on the ballot, particularly at the bottom of the ballot, which they typically are.
Yeah.
You know, they're just going to be like, oh, who's that? Okay, fine. On we go. I like an R. I vote for the R. Or I vote for the D. It doesn't really matter who they are or what they did in that whole thing. I think with a governor, you tend to have more accountability.
Now, let me ask you about that. Let's look at what happened in Flint with the string of emergency mm-hmm. managers appointed mm-hmm. by the governor. How mm-hmm. accountable were they as all of that was happening?
Well, that's exactly right. And the question, and that you're getting kind of, the next piece of this is, mm-hmm. is how do you choose these people? Mm-hmm. Now, you and I have talked about this before, and I think that What happened in Flint was an example of really poor choices on the part of the governor and his team. And the best antidote to that is, I think, what we saw happen in the Detroit bankruptcy, where they hired Kevin Orr, who was a Washington, D.C. bankruptcy lawyer who was not part of the Detroit political establishment. His only connection to Michigan was that he went to Michigan Law School 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the case in Flint was, if you look at the backgrounds of those city, those emergency managers, rather, almost every, if not every one of them, was part of the, in some way, of the Flint political establishment. They had alliances, they had interests, they had buddies, they had enemies. Very different thing as opposed to somebody who comes in from the outside to say, you are here to do a job, and we don't want you to care about the political alliances. So I think that's one of the things that you got to keep in mind. The other thing, too, is how do you pick these people? Now, when you talk about gubernatorial appointments, people think it's always necessarily the smoke-filled room. Okay, so there are efforts and there are ways to get around that. One is you could have a nominating committee, a bipartisan nominating committee, that vets candidates and then makes recommendations to the board, or to the governor, rather. That might be a possibility. How do you take some partisanship out of it? Well, maybe you have the governor could appoint different people from both parties. And frankly, I think people who are professional tend to be more professional. They're not necessarily going to be so partisan. But I think people need to look at ways to reform this, because if we keep doing it the way we've been doing it, we're going to get the same result.
Turning to Michigan State, what do you make of the fact that Interim President John Engler asked Attorney General Bill Schuette to take his name off the list of endorsements for Schuette's campaign for governor?
Well, I think he's been reading some of us in the media, for one thing. Secondly, it strikes me as kind of closing the barn door after the horse is out. I mean, he can take his name off, but anybody who followed this story is going to know going forward that they are political allies. So trying to make it look like I'm not supporting the AG who's investigating the university I am now heading, it's window dressing at the end of the day. Does it change the reality of the fact that John Engler appointed Bill Schuette to a job in the new Engler administration in 1990 after Schuette lost in his bid for the U.S. Senate? No, it doesn't. Does it change the fact that he came out early and was an early supporter, and on the record, an early supporter of Bill Schuette? No, it doesn't change it. So taking your name off a list is fine. It's probably required given the circumstances, but it doesn't change the reality.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts, and you'll get the link. When it comes to a company's bottom line, diversity matters. Over the last couple of years on The Next Idea, we've discussed with our partner Jeff DeGraff and others about the importance of diversity in all its forms when it comes to finding true innovations, the kind that change lives and grow businesses. And our next guests show that this emphasis on diversity is not just because it's politically correct or some kumbaya message that we should all get along. Last weekend, with DeGraff's guidance, the second Lear Open Innovation Challenge got into full swing with pitch competitions from teams of college students in Michigan vying for internships and prizes. Now, the reason that Lear Corporation, which we remind you is a leading Tier 1 auto parts supplier, is holding a second Innovation Challenge is because the first one was such a surprising and resounding success. Here with us now are two members of that first winning team. Salem Maruf is an engineering student at Wayne State University. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
And Brandon Dix is studying engineering at U of M Dearborn. Brandon, welcome.
Thank you. This is very exciting.
And with us is Bob Humphrey. He's director of global innovation management at Lear Corporation. Bob, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Why, Bob, did Lear decide to do this challenge with undergraduates? I mean, Lear is an $18 billion company of 140,000 employees. Why was this worth Lear's time and effort?
Yeah, so innovation to us is about an ecosystem. So it's not just internally. There's a bunch of external portions to that as well. And the big value we see in it is our teams, because we do the same thing on a daily basis, we get stuck in these paradigms, these constraints that may or may not exist. by bringing in university students of multiple levels, they don't see those same constraints. They don't know what can't be done.
They have fresh eyes.
Exactly. So they're able to help us get past those items that we're just assuming can't happen.
So that old thing about you can't see the forest for the trees.
Absolutely.
What were your expectations going in? I'm wondering if you had any doubts, any concerns.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I didn't know what to expect. But I did have some doubts based on how technical the challenge was that we gave the students. We really dug into something that our teams had been working on for some time and developed some expertise on. So I wasn't sure if they'd be able to pick it up in such a short time period.
All right. I know there are some proprietary issues here in terms of just how specific you can get. But what was basically the problem that you were looking to solve?
Yeah. So we challenged them with, in general terms, reducing the size and weight of today's electrical distribution systems. We all know electrical content in cars is growing and continues to grow based on feature content and safety content. So we're looking at ways at minimizing that growth so we can stay within the same vehicle package.
Vehicle package size is not going to change.
No, it's not. And we have less and less room. That's high priority space in there. So we need to keep our package to a minimum.
So this is something that Lear has been chipping away at and digging into.
Absolutely. This wasn't made up just for the challenge. This is something that's very important to us.
So two students who made it all the way through the challenge are with us now. Salim Maruf, walk us through the process, starting with the workshop at the beginning.
All right. So the Innovation Challenge hosted by Lear was a two-day event initially. So the first day, we were first divided by colors. So there was four colors, red, blue, green, and yellow. Each of us was actually assigned a color. Brandon was blue, and I myself was red. We were going through a bunch of educational presentations about what Lear does, what they do with the seating, and what they do electrical-wise. And we focused in on the electrical systems specifically because that's what our challenge was related to. And towards the end, we mainly just looked at the presentations and tried to learn from there, like what we could do for that challenge.
So you started off basically with some grounding in this is there and this is the problem.
Exactly, because some of us didn't even know what a crimp was and what anything related to that challenge was.
How did the colors work?
Okay, so each color represents a different theme. Red is more like process-based, blue is more business-oriented, yellow is collaboration, and green is like innovation, new thinking.
Brandon, how did the diversity on your team help you guys solve the problem?
It was great. I was really happy that we were able to choose our team based on that diversity. So we had, you know, every color of the rainbow, you could say. And working throughout the 2 weeks, you could definitely tell that it was beneficial to have someone from every segment.
Yeah. So yeah. The big picture was stronger because
exactly.
of that.
Yep.
Salim, what did it feel like to have a major company like Lear come to you? You're a sophomore. Engineering yeah. student, undergrad engineering student, and say, we want to know what you think.
It was different. I mean, it's weird having a big company like that come up to a random student and ask for that much help. And it honestly felt great. It was a big confidence booster. I mean, speaking for myself, like I just switched from nursing and having a big company like that come to me and ask me for my help really made me believe that I could actually go further in engineering. And it turns out after that summer, like it really helped and it showed that.
Bob, how'd they do?
They did great. I mean, they ended up with four invention disclosures.
And what are those?
So within our company, anytime we have a new, we believe something's new or novel, we submit an invention disclosure in our system to check for that. So that's the first step in creating a patent. So there were four unique things that our teams had not come up with yet. So it was amazing.
That these undergrads came up with their fresh eyes, came up with four possible brand new
Absolutely.
Ideas.
Absolutely. And the beauty was it seemed so simple when they were done with it, but it was something we didn't see originally.
Can you give us any sense of just how helpful the solutions that these students came up with could be for Lear's bottom line, future growth?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest thing is it obviously varies by vehicle content and vehicle size, but they were in the neighborhood of, I believe it was 10 to 15% weight reduction and a 20 to 30% size reduction, which is huge, not in the sense that it's eliminating that from the vehicle today, but like I said earlier, it kind of creates that room for that future growth. We're not getting more package size. So what they did is allow us to keep up with those market trends and stay ahead of them, actually, in the needs of our customers and the needs of the market.
What role do you feel, knowing how it all worked, that diversity played in giving this kind of success to these groups?
Oh, man, it was a huge role. I know the teams, these guys will probably tell you it was a struggle in the beginning because it caused some conflict within the team. They were getting frustrated with each other. But what it allowed them to do is stretch beyond just a simple solution. These guys are pretty process-oriented and pretty driven to get to a solution, and they probably wouldn't have gotten to the same place without other of their team members stretching them and saying, wait, is that right? Is that enough? And challenging them.
So these are skills that any American corporation would be very happy to have, I'm gathering, as far as being able to build that team.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you don't have it, you're completely missing out on being able to keep up with the future.
Brandon and Salim, I want to know what you took away from this experience. Brandon, I'll start with you.
You know, it was great seeing Lear. They may not have the resources to pay a full-time engineer to go through all these crazy ideas. Them coming to us just to really research as university students, you know, we had the time and the interest checking out everything. It was, I would say, very beneficial for my education, kind of putting an idea on what I've been learning in school.
Mm-hmm. Getting out of the classroom.
Yeah, exactly. Being able to apply it to something in real life.
Yeah. Selene, what about you?
And going beyond that, it's being in that environment surrounded by all those engineers, surrounded by all that equipment that we learned how to use. It really put us in an environment where we felt like engineers. We had a role as an engineer. We worked as a team. We gained lots of knowledge in working with a team because that's what engineers usually do. Time management was a big thing that we learned, and communication as well was really big. So the big takeaway was just we felt like engineers, and that's exciting to feel in the middle of our education.
Very motivating for our degrees.
So when we think about how happy Lear was with this Open Innovation Challenge, what do you guys think that you and other college students bring to a corporation like Lear?
Touching on what Bob said earlier, you know, we weren't told everything that they looked into and why it didn't work. So we didn't know why something wouldn't work, so we had to look into it and find for ourselves if that wouldn't work. So we're challenging Lear in that way.
Adding to that, many automotive companies right now are just doing what they've been doing for years and years and years. And having fresh minds like Brandon and I come in, it really changes the game and it gives a different outlook on what like we wanted to happen to a big company like Lear.
Bob, we've seen that this first innovation challenge was quite a success, as we hear from Brandon and Salim's stories. So you're happy to the point of doing it again. What are you looking for this year?
Well, I know my expectations are much bigger this year. So we've challenged the students this year a little broader topic around the idea of safety within an automotive vehicle. Went through some pitches last weekend. They were spectacular, and we're really looking forward to what the team will deliver this year. I mean, Sam and Brendan and their team set a pretty high bar, so we're expecting big things out of the teams this year.
You guys actually took your experience from the first challenge, and what'd you do this year with the second challenge?
Yeah, so coming back to the new teams, they actually doubled the size of the competition this year, so there were double the amount of teams. So we were able to kind of walk around and mentor and kind of coach students on, you know, when they were struggling, show them that we were struggling at that same point and that it still can turn successful.
Yeah, stress isn't necessarily always a bad thing. So we were trying to let other teams around us know that it's okay to be stressed, it's okay to have those moments, but always make it lead to a positive outcome.
What a great life lesson to learn in anything, right, Bob?
Absolutely.
Bob, what is the big takeaway for Lear as a company, particularly the idea of what would you tell other corporations about taking this approach?
Yeah, so I think there were a couple takeaways. The biggest being is what we talked about earlier. They did give us yet another way to, you know, kind of lead the market and keep up with those market trends. But I think the more important piece, and probably maybe less obvious, is that we were connected to some really talented individuals, such as Brandon and Salim, as well as their teammates, that we believe are going to be capable of much bigger things in the future.
Good for resumes.
Yeah. They invested in us.
Indeed. Bob Humphrey from Lear Corporation, Salim Maroof, who is a Wayne State University engineering student, and Brandon Dix, engineering student at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Well, congratulations on proving with the first competition that it works, so you go ahead and do a second Lear Open Innovation Challenge. Thanks for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Next time on Stateside.
There are 500,000 people in this country sitting each day in jail simply because they can't make bail.
And that is why one U of M law grad has come up with an idea, affordable bail insurance, noting that people out on bail fare better in the legal system than those who can't make bail.
Bail is being used as a major point of leverage to get plea deals out of people.
That is Monday right here on Stateside. Today's show is directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.